This is the first time I've ever given a lecture in Wellington boots. And they're three sizes too big. So if I fall off, it's not drink. Despite those of my friends who I saw here who immediately make the alternative assumption. Tomorrow evening, as I'm sure you're all aware, throughout the country, communities will be gathering in vigil to mark the centenary of the Battle of the Somme. They will do so principally because on the 1st of July 1916, the British Army suffered its heaviest losses in a single day. Proportionally, other battles, including Waterloo, have actually been more costly. The Somme losses were great, in part because Britain had never put an army that big into the field before. 1.3 million men, roughly, in June 1916, which was 13 times bigger than the British Expeditionary Force, which went to France at the outbreak of the war. And about 45 times bigger, don't challenge me on that, but I have a quick fag packet calculation, 45 times bigger than the British forces at Waterloo. Douglas Haig's dispatches and Douglas Haig's defenders argue that although the Battle of the Somme was not a strategic victory, it was, to quote Gary Sheffield, a strategic success. And what they mean by that is that it played a major role in weakening the German army so that the knockout blow could be delivered in 1918. In other words, and Andrew Roberts makes exactly this argument in his book on the Somme called Elegy, in other words, the victories of the British Army in the 100 days of 1918 were made possible by what had gone on in the Somme 2 years before, and that those victories therefore played a crucial part in winning the war. Now, I would argue, and I have a slightly vested interest, as Vivian Harmsworth's introduction made clear, I have an interest in this, I would argue that the last 2 years of centenary commemoration has been a successful exercise in public education. The public appetite, the public interest in the war has increased rather than diminished. There are some members of the UK Advisory Committee who say we're fed up with the war, but then when you look outside, and you look at, for example, BBC surveying of its audience and so on, what you see is that the public is more interested now in 2016, rather, than it was in 2014. But at this point, in 2016, the public may be a little confused, because only a month ago, they were being told then, as we commemorated the Battle of Jutland, that that too was a strategic success, if not a tactical victory, that it was, to quote, the battle that won the war. That is the title given to what the National Museum of the Royal Navy is calling its, to quote, incredible new blockbuster exhibition. And some of you may have seen it. It's now on in Portsmouth. Both claims, the claim for the Battle of the Somme and the claim for the Battle of Jutland, are quite frankly preposterous. Neither the Somme nor Jutland was a decisive battle. Indeed, the very need to engage in those forms of hyperbole arises precisely from the fact that their outcomes were so unclear, both at the time and have remained so ever since. The war, after all, did not end in 1916, but went on for two more years, going through many twists and turns before it finally came to its conclusion, and historians, of course, being postmodernists, don't even think it ended in November 1918, and I'm actually probably with them on that. But anyway, we won't go there today. I've only got 45 minutes or so, and we probably already had five of them. The twists and turns included both the US entry to the war and two Russian revolutions, seismic events, even by comparison with the commemorations of this year of the Somme and of Jutland. The First World War was simply far too complex, far too extensive geographically, and far too all-embracing in its demands of individual states to be explained by the performance of any one country, any one of those countries' armed services, or by the outcome of a single battle. But this argument about whether the Somme was the decisive battle of the First World War or Jutland was the decisive battle of the First World War is not just an argument about the strategy that underpinned the conduct of that war. It is also a longer-running argument about British power and its use in the First World War and about the relative roles of the Army and Navy within that. So what I want to do is take you back from 1916 or 2016 or wherever metaphorically you're currently sitting. It's rather hard to tell, I have to say, in the lights in my eyes, but I assume you're out there somewhere. I want to take you back from 1916 to 1904. On the 25th of January, 1904, Halford Mackinder, an Oxford-educated geographer, and yes, you know, for those of you who are critical of geography as a subject, this was an era when Oxford had just begun teaching geography. An Oxford-educated geographer delivered a lecture at the Royal Geographical Society in London called The Geographical Pivot of History. It was an important lecture because it did effectively found the study of geopolitics as a subject in Britain. And he described a world which had been, as he put it, fully explored and fully politicized. And what he meant by that was that all its territories had been penetrated, and of course in an imperial era that meant penetrated by Europeans, had become known to Europeans, and their frontiers had been defined by Europeans or by their empires very largely. It was, Mackinder said, a closed political system. And as a result, he also said, to quote him, every explosion of social forces, instead of being dissipated in a surrounding circuit of unknown space and barbaric chaos, will be sharply re-echoed from the far side of the globe, and weak elements in the political and economic organization of the world will be shattered in consequence. Mackinder's generation lived in what we today, with all the arrogance of the present, see as a phenomenon unique to our own times. They lived, as we do, or as we say we do, in a globalized, interconnected world. It's a somewhat pejorative statement because the world was global before we called it globalized. But anyway, in 1914, 59 countries of the world, and that was an awful lot of them, were on the gold standard and engaged in international trade, largely brokered through the merchant banks, the insurance companies, and the shipping firms of the City of London. And those were Britain's economic strengths in 1914, at a point where its industrial productive power had slipped from being first in the world to being third, second to, or third to, Germany and the United States. Mackinder saw those commercial advantages related to maritime power not so much as strengths, rather as vulnerabilities. He argued that access to the sea and to global trade was no longer going to be the basis of empire. The great empires of the past, Venice, Spain, Holland, and of course Britain itself, had rested their reach precisely on their capacity to use the sea. But for Mackinder, the railway was changing the conditions of land powers, and in particular was opening up what Mackinder called the closed heartland of Eurasia. Now, he said, thanks to the railway, land masses would dominate and prevail over the control of the seas. And the world island, as he put it, Eurasia, would be the landmass that really mattered. Mackinder specifically attacked the prevailing orthodoxy, which rested on the supremacy of maritime power, and which had been propagated in particular 14 years beforehand by the American naval captain Alfred Thayer Mahan in his bestseller, The Influence of Sea Power Upon History. Two world wars later, and many in Britain reckoned Mackinder was right and that Mahan had been wrong. Britain, after all, formed a mass continental army and did so for war in Europe, not just in 1916, but once again in 1939-45. And after the Second World War was over, it left the British Army there on the Rhine. And indeed, its remnants are still there, even if they're finally just about to come home now in 2016. In 1976, Paul Kennedy, the author of a book that some of you may remember from 20 years ago, I'm losing track of time, The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers. In 1976, a somewhat younger Paul Kennedy published a book called The Rise and Fall of British Naval Mastery. Part two of the book was called Zenith, and it ended with a chapter called Mahan versus Mackinder. Paul Kennedy argued, to put his argument in a simplified form, that Mackinder's logic had indeed replaced Mahan's. So the fall, to use the title of part three of his book, was inevitable. For Kennedy, the First World War had proved that the inherent strengths accorded an island power no longer held. States that were powerful enough raised both a navy and an army, and continental powers like Germany, therefore, were stronger than purely insular and maritime ones like Britain. For him, the British blockade, the British waging of economic war during the years 1914-18 was ineffective and had only subsidiary consequences. Instead, Kennedy argued, waging land warfare had sapped the manpower, economy, and morale of the Central Powers at a far higher rate than any effects gained by the use of the maritime blockade. Now, of course, that was music to the ears of the supporters of Douglas Haig. In particular, John Terrane, a man who in 1963 had written a biography of Douglas Haig called Haig, the Educated Soldier. If anybody's here from Brasenose, you will know, of course, that the claim to education derives from his being at Brasenose, not that he left with a very good degree. But the title was an immediate challenge and provocation to describe him as an educated soldier in any sense. Terrane had written that book, and Terrane had used Haig's own argument, reflected in what I've just said, in the words of Gary Sheffield and Andrew Roberts and later supporters of Haig, that the Somme should be judged not from the perspective of what happened in 1916, but from that of Haig's own final dispatch. In 1919, Douglas Haig, when he gave up the command of the British Expeditionary Force, wrote a long dispatch to the Secretary of State for War in which he explained that what had been begun on the Somme in 1916 should be seen as part of one long and continuous battle that had found its conclusion in November 1918. And what John Terrane went on to say was that for the first and only time in its history, Britain had contributed to a continental victory by raising a mass army and fighting against the main opponent in the principal theatre of war within Europe. Now, it is precisely that argument that so infuriates the National Museum of the Royal Navy as it mounts its exhibition this year on Jutland. What the Royal Navy and its protagonists are saying is that Jutland was a victory precisely because it kept the blockade of Germany in place, and it was the blockade, more than any fighting on the Western Front, that won the war. Never mind, according to this argument, that that German high seas fleet did not come out specifically to break the blockade on the 31st of May 1916. Instead, what it wanted to do was lure Beatty's battle cruisers into a trap. It certainly did not anticipate confronting Jellicoe's Grand Fleet, and the moment it did so, of course, it turned tail and made its way back to harbour as best it could. Never mind either that Jellicoe had no need to fight a battle at Jutland to maintain the blockade. Indeed, as Churchill memorably said, Jellicoe, of course, could have lost the war in an afternoon, precisely because taking the fleet into action only jeopardised a situation in which the Royal Navy was already master. But here in 2016, as opposed to the situation Paul Kennedy found himself in 1976, the Royal Navy has contemporary opinion rather more on its side than it did 40 years ago. In 1976, Britain had, of course, turned away from its empire. The drift, very much in British defence policy, was that the commitment to NATO's defence against the Soviet Union and, of course, to the protection of the inner German border was its preeminent requirement, and that, of course, was a job for the army. Europe needed a continental commitment. And of course, now, in an era when we regard Europe for all the threats of terrorism, for refugee flows and all the rest of it, in an era in which we regard Europe as comparatively more secure than it seemed to be in 1976, we can take a rather different view about how we judge that balance of naval versus military power. After all, the Brexit vote itself is only imaginable in the context of comparative security or comparative complacency about security within Europe. And the rise of China and of India, as well, of course, as the decision of the United States, at least as adumbrated by President Obama in January 2012, to pivot to Asia and the Pacific, remind us that we, like those of Mackinder's generation, live, to quote him, in an increasingly globalized world. So let me take you back once again to Mackinder's 1904 lecture. Mackinder was a liberal imperialist. As Britain faced relative industrial decline, especially given the rapid growth of Germany and the United States, the liberal imperialists argued that imperial efficiency, which meant essentially greater imperial cohesion, and tariff reform, that is essentially imperial preference rather than free trade, should be the axioms of the future. What they sought to do was to reconstruct the empire on lines which would maximize its economic and military potential. So the point of Mackinder's lecture was not actually to say that Britain should accept inevitable decline. It should not simply go with what geography and geopolitics dictated. It was rather to say that Britain should think, how should it respond to the challenge which both geography and geopolitics presented? After all, nobody could pick Britain up and put it somewhere else. Britain was going to remain an island relatively close to the continent of Europe. It couldn't move into Central Europe in order to become part of the Euro-Asian heartland. What Mackinder was saying was that Britain had to develop a much broader view of strategy, which integrated its economic, military, and naval components, and which embraced Britain's policy in peace as well as in war, and which optimized its sea power, not rejected it. The 1904 lecture was not, in fact, a rejection of maritime power, but a case for its redefinition. And this was not a quest that Mackinder had begun all on his own. It was something that many others were arguing in Britain at the turn of the century as well. And in 1902, the British government established what today we would call a National Security Council. It established a Committee of Imperial Defence designed to bring the senior service chiefs and the respective government ministers together under the chairmanship of the Prime Minister in order to address British imperial defence policy. In the very same year, Mackinder wrote a book called Britain and the British Isles, which stated clearly that the defence of Britain rested above all on its command of the sea, and went on to say that if Britain declined economically to such an extent that its navy could no longer match those of its competitors, it should, he said, create, to quote, a navy of all Britons. And what he meant by that was a navy resourced not only by the empire, but also by the United States. We're getting there. Rather merry American Institute. Sea power was the central element of British defence policy in 1914. On the 30th of June 1914, the ship owners of the British Empire possessed just short of 50% of the world's gross registered tonnage. And this and the Royal Navy were the assets that it brought to the alliance when war broke out in August 1914. What mattered to the French during the July crisis of 1914 was not the dispatch of the British Expeditionary Force to Europe. As many Frenchmen said, and this is attributed to several of them in 1914, all they wanted was one British soldier, and that British soldier should be killed, because then, of course, the commitment would be absolute. In practice, the BEF mustered just under 100,000 men when Continental armies on mobilization in 1914 approached nearly 3 million men. In other words, the BEF was a mere bagatelle in this sort of exchange of manpower. What mattered instead to the French was the Anglo-French Naval Agreement of 1912 and the British commitment within that agreement to secure France's northern coast. And that was the point that Paul Cambon, the French ambassador in London, stressed to the British Foreign Secretary, Sir Edward Grey, repeatedly in the late days of July. And from Paris, the British ambassador there, Lord Bertie, said that a British commitment could deter Germany from going to war because, he said, Germany could not afford the risk of its seaborne trade being destroyed or of Germany being starved out by the British fleet. Even a French soldier, the Deputy Chief of the General Staff in 1914, Edouard de Castelnau, who is today venerated in France as one of the key figures, there's always a debate about this in France, but certainly one of the key figures who decided that Verdun should be held in 1916, de Castelnau believed, as he put it, that Britain's contribution to France would be exactly here, at sea. He was not concerned, despite being a soldier, about there being a British army on the continent. What he anticipated was the role of British sea power producing quick results. If there was a short war illusion in 1914, it derived and was based on the effect that British blockade would have on German stock markets and on German food supplies. When Sir Edward Grey addressed the House of Commons in what is meant to be one of the great parliamentary moments, the debate, debate's too strong a word because he just spoke to the House and there was no division of the House, on the 3rd of August, the day before the ultimatum expired to Germany, when he spoke to the House to explain the state of affairs in Europe, he said that the British Expeditionary Force would go not to Europe, but to protect the colonies. And his vision of war for Britain was almost exclusively maritime. Indeed, he said, whether we go to war or whether we do not go to war, we will be seriously affected precisely because we are a maritime and trading country. Within a week, of course, he was proved wrong. Britain had committed itself to sending the BEF to France, and in due course, to creating a mass army for continental warfare. The implications for British strategy and for pre-war notions of imperial defence were profound. What happened, of course, with the creation of a mass army, with Kitchener's appeal to men, with that poster that you all know so well. What happened was that men were taken from smaller firms that then found themselves unable to continue production and therefore had to close for lack of labour. And the state became the principal purchaser of goods as industry shifted overwhelmingly to munitions production and to the exclusion of non-essential industries. The state became the principal purchaser of goods. The consequence was that exports declined, with significant implications for the British balance of payments. And of course, as Britain placed an increasing number of orders overseas, and especially in the United States, that problem only deepened. It's worth remembering that the effect of the war in 1914 was almost immediately to lift the United States out of economic depression. The balance of payments deficit had potential implications for the standing and convertibility of the pound sterling, which was, after all, the principal international currency. Ostensibly, states may have been on the gold standard, but the price of gold was set in sterling. If Britain let the dollar-sterling exchange rate shift too much, then, of course, the cost of the munitions orders paid in the United States would soar. And that would hit not only Britain, but increasingly also its allies. Because by 1916, those allies, Russia, France, and Italy, all depended on Britain to fund their orders in the United States. So Britain's financial power and its maritime capability as its underpinning factor were central to how Britain saw its war effort. In 1915, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Reginald McKenna, opposed conscription. And his reason for doing so was that Britain's contribution to the war was to be as an arsenal, financier, and global trader. It was not to be the possessor of a mass continental army. And he felt these were direct alternatives, that Britain, if it created a mass continental army, and Kitchener at this stage was talking about an army of 60 divisions or possibly 70 divisions, then it would cease to be able to trade overseas at all, and so, of course, would face an increasing problem in its capacity to import. Nonetheless, in 1916, the government moved to the introduction of conscription and effectively decided to do both, to fight a long-term economic war and to support a mass army in the field to sustain its allies in the short term. The argument being that if the French collapsed in the short term, there would be no long-term war to win. Conscription, when it came in 1916, was not just about keeping the Navy up to strength. It was also about balancing the needs of the army and domestic production. The vast majority of cases of those who sought exemption from conscription and from compulsory military service appealed to their local tribunals, not on grounds of conscientious objection. And conscientious objectors were a very small number of those who appealed for exemption. They appealed instead on the basis that the work that they were engaged in was war-related and vital to Britain's war effort. And indeed, many tribunals, and some evidence suggests indeed the majority of tribunals, were overwhelmingly sympathetic to exactly such applications and did grant exemptions from military service, at least in the short term. Britain's strategy was that it could win the war in the long term, provided it did not lose it in the short term. The Entente powers could command the resources of three major empires, Britain, France, and Russia. And it could, by dint of its control of the oceans, secure the resources of the neutrals as well, and particularly, of course, of those of the United States. Now, the man who embodied this approach was a Royal Marine called Maurice Hankey, Secretary to the Committee of Imperial Defence at the war's outbreak, and Secretary to the War Cabinet from 1916 onwards, a man who is in many respects regarded as the founder of modern cabinet government. He was particularly close to Lloyd George after he became Prime Minister, and Hankey was in many respects the strategic brain of the British government. He was, as befits a Royal Marine, a firm believer in the centrality of sea power in the achievement of ultimate victory. On the 28th of November 1914, Hankey wrote a memorandum which is known as the Boxing Day Memorandum. It's amazing how many First World War memoranda were written on Boxing Day or Christmas Day. There was clearly an overwhelming desire to get away from the pressures of family life and get on with the business of running the war instead. And that memorandum addressed the stalemate of the Western Front and suggested alternatives, both on other fronts and through the use of new tactical solutions. What is often remembered from this particular memorandum and from the response to it of the First Lord of the Admiralty, Winston Churchill, is the commitment to the Dardanelles campaign. On the one hand, that was a strategic solution, and the development of the tank, which of course was a tactical solution. But at the heart of Hankey's memorandum was his faith in what he called the tremendous asset of sea power and its resultant economic pressure. Churchill began his memorandum, which was written on New Year's Eve, for a man who was a serious drinker, it's surprising that that was when he was putting pen to paper, in which he said, "The war will be ended by the exhaustion of nations rather than by the victories of armies." What both Hankey and Churchill were doing was stressing that the defensive role of sea power was to sustain Britain's trade and its control of the sea lines of communication, and that the offensive role of sea power was to tighten the blockade of Germany and the Central Powers. Britain's strategy for winning the war was long-term and attritional in a much broader sense than that used by the generals fighting on the Western Front. It required constant patrolling at sea in all weathers. It depended on the collection of commercial intelligence, something for which there was no database in 1914. And it demanded adroit diplomacy to ensure that it did not alienate the neutrals, and of course, particularly the most important neutral of all, the United States. What it did not require was a major fleet action in the North Sea. The strategic challenge facing Germany and its allies was much more complicated and compounded precisely because neither Germany individually nor the Central Powers collectively ever developed either a proper understanding of strategy on this scale or the institutional machinery to carry it into effect. Germany faced two intractable problems. First of all, it was a land power and it had no means of directly attacking Britain, which most in Germany saw as the hub of the enemy alliance, precisely because of its economic and maritime reach. And secondly, the longer the war went on, the less likely Germany was to win it. The man who saw this most clearly and tried to produce a solution to this problem was the German Chief of the General Staff, Erich von Falkenhayn, who, by the winter of 1915-16, had a model which effectively said, first of all, let's Germany find a separate peace with one of the Entente partners, and in his view, Russia would be the ideal one. He tried that in 1915, but it hadn't come off. Secondly, attack France so that Britain no longer has a significant military ally on the continent, or in the west of Europe. France, after all, has the bigger and major army, and therefore finds itself unable to sustain in isolation a significant military presence in Europe. And thirdly, simultaneously attack Britain by the only option open to the German Navy, which was unrestricted U-boat warfare. Falkenhayn, when he launched the Battle of Verdun in February 1916, wanted to accompany it with a U-boat campaign. But in 1916, the Kaiser, although he shilly-shallied, as he always did, Bismarck memorably said, the Kaiser is like a balloon. You need to hang on very tight to the string because you don't know where it's going to go if you let it release it. In 1916, the Kaiser would not approve unrestricted U-boat warfare. And with the Germans checked at Verdun, all three elements of Falkenhayn's strategy had effectively been called into question. The decision to put the High Seas Fleet to sea on the 31st of May 1916 did not represent a German desire to break the blockade. It reflected rather the frustration of the German Navy, specifically at its inability to do anything at sea of any consequence whatsoever. As I've already said, what it wanted to do was to engage fractions of Beatty's battlecruisers. I don't mean fractions that they'd already broken up. He did quite a lot of the breaking up. The Germans did quite a lot of breaking up at Jutland. But fractions of Beatty's battlecruiser fleet in the hope that they could sink a few, as indeed they did. What they were seeking, in other words, was tactical attrition, not decisive battle. And in this, of course, the High Seas Fleet was extraordinarily successful. Rather more so, I have to say, than tactical attrition as it was conducted by British generals on the Western Front. By the end of 1916, Germany was running out of options, and its response in December 1916 was to propose peace negotiations. Historians always used to see this as a cynical German ploy. The Central Powers had just overrun Romania, and so the proposal came on the back of yet another unequivocal victory on the Eastern Front. The Germans, it was argued, did not want to get peace, and certainly not on the terms which would be acceptable to them. What they wanted to do was to show to the United States that they were willing to try for peace, and so hoped that when they then had to turn to unrestricted U-boat warfare, the Americans would indulge them. The Americans would say, well, you know, we know you tried to get peace, we understand, therefore, why you've had to turn to unrestricted U-boat warfare, and therefore why you're sinking American ships and killing Americans at sea. Today's German historians say that the German peace offer of December 1916 was not just a pretense, that it was genuinely meant. And indeed, not one peace attempt failed in 1916, but two. Because when the German attempt got nowhere, Woodrow Wilson himself, the American president, stepped in and tried to act as the broker. So when, in early 1917, the decision to move to U-boat warfare was taken by the Germans, which did indeed bring the Americans into the war, this was not necessarily unbridled folly. It's always presented as the final nail in the coffin of the Germans' effort to win the war, that after April 1917, German defeat is inevitable. And of course, in the long term, that was right. By mid-1918, the Americans reckoned they have an army in Europe by 1919 of fully 4 million men, more than twice the size of the British and French armies individually, and equivalent to them when they were put together in November 1918. In other words, if you had an army of 4 million men in Europe coming from the United States by 1919, the war would be won. So Germany would have lost in the long term, but they would almost certainly have lost in the long term even without the entry of the United States. And the Germans knew that. So the questions the Germans confronted in the early part of 1917 was not what would happen in the long term, but could they possibly win the war in the short term, which was the reason, of course, for going for unrestricted U-boat warfare. And here there was some method in their madness, it would seem. By late 1916, Britain was spending $250 million a month in the United States, both on its own behalf and on behalf of its allies. The US shareholder had effectively invested in an Entente victory a point the Federal Reserve Board made to the US shareholder in November 1916. US industry was booming precisely because of orders from the Entente powers. So in German eyes, in a war of material, the United States was no longer neutral. Or if it were neutral, it was only nominally neutral. Its industry was effectively enlisted on one side only. In this respect, the German decision to move to unrestricted U-boat war was, although a gamble, an entirely logical gamble. What was less logical was the failure to link the submarine war to the war on land. As already said, in 1916, Falkenhayn had wanted to link the two, but had been thwarted. In 1917, his successor, Hindenburg, and his sidekick, Ludendorff, waged successful campaigns in the east against Russia and against the rump of Romania, and in the south against Italy. But they waged no such campaign in the west. And as a result, the opportunity to put the Western allies, Britain and France, under simultaneous pressure on land and sea was not taken. By mid-1918, Germany dominated the Euro-Asia heartland, to use Mackinder's phrase. Its borders ran from very close to Paris in the west, and of course with most of Flanders and Belgium as well, across to the Baltic states, down through European Russia, to Ukraine, and to the Caucasus. These were conquests not quite as great as those of Hitler in 1940-41, but not far off. Mackinder's nightmare of 1904 had been fulfilled, and yet Germany lost the war. It did so because it lost what we might call, in the language of the Second World War, the Battle of the Atlantic. By April 1917, the Entente powers faced bankruptcy. Britain had an overdraft of $350 million in the United States as a result of the Federal Reserve Board's warning to the American shareholders of November 1916 against the dangers of American overinvestment in an Entente victory. That supply of borrowing had by and large dried up. Britain was spending $75 million a week in the US, but could no longer borrow in the US to pay for it. So US entry to the war saved the Entente from financial collapse. Germany was, of course, right in the short term, in that the United States Army was not ready to go to war in Europe. But the United States Navy was. Rear Admiral W.S. Sims, commanding the US Naval Forces, reached Britain on the 9th of April, 3 days after the US declared war on Germany. And the US brought with them their destroyers, which were so vitally needed as convoy escorts in the submarine war. On the 31st of May 1917, Lord Northcliffe was sent out to the United States to coordinate all the British missions there. He was based not in Washington, but in New York, and so was separate from, as indeed he was frequently at odds with, the British ambassador, Cecil Spring Rice, the man we remember today for writing I Vow to Thee My Country. Northcliffe became the conduit which linked the US government directly to British and Allied purchasing, shipping, and finance. As he put it, "I have to deal with all these topics, ships, iron, steel, brass, copper, bacon, sugar, cotton, grain, shells, horses, railway trains, oil, and money, money, money." He wrote to his mother in August 1917, "We go to the United States for our monthly dole of £37.5 million. In fact, the number always seemed to be on an upward trajectory, both from his perspective and, of course, from the point of view of those in London. A month later, in September 1917, as the Third Battle of Ypres reached its midpoint, Northcliffe wrote again to his mother, "If the Americans withhold their payment to us for as much as 24 hours, there would be a financial crash that would mean a German victory." The US drove a hard bargain, but as a result, they improved Allied coordination, and in particular, they helped fix prices and promote the pooling of resources without inter-Allied competition. Northcliffe returned to London in November, but continued to lead the mission until February 1918. By then, the crisis in the war at sea was over. Allied plans for victory in 1919, with the US contribution at their heart, were being put in place. Cutting off the trade of the neutrals as a result of the US entry had tightened the blockade. The world's leading neutral, now a belligerent, meant that Britain too could afford to be less wary of neutral and international reaction against economic warfare. Northcliffe wrote to his mother in October 1917, "There is no sympathy here for Germany or any other neutrals. The Americans are a drastic people. They regard Sweden, Norway, Holland, Spain, Switzerland, and Denmark," these are all neutral states, of course, adjacent to Germany, as many mouths feeding Germany. Secondly, shipbuilding, i.e. the construction of merchant as well as military tonnage, moved to the top of British priorities in 1918. The Army's needs for manpower in 1918 came third in rank order after shipbuilding and the production of aircraft. And in the States, Northcliffe urged exactly the same point on America. Giving a speech in Detroit, he said, "What use are tractors and automobiles to you if you are not able to get them across if you have not the ships to transport them in quantities?" In October 1917, Britain asked the United States to construct 6 million tons of shipping per year, so effectively jeopardizing the long-term competitiveness of Britain's own merchant fleet for the sake of the short-term aim of winning the war. When the war ended in November 1918, effectively a year ahead of schedule, it came as a big surprise. In August 1918, Northcliffe had written to his nephew, after all this is only 3 months before the end of the war, that he was confident about the war's outcome because of America's contribution to it. But, he went on, the war will be long, very long. Nobody was expecting the war to end as quickly as it did. What he said was very much the prevailing view. Both then and now, historians have sought to explain the rapidity of the Central Powers' collapse. One reason was that as the alliance of the Entente and its associate, the United States, became tighter, that of the Central Powers fragmented. This was a coalition victory underpinned by economic coordination and sea power. But in Britain, we have more partial views. The British Army argued, and perhaps argues, to paraphrase John Terrain, that indeed, for the first time in its history, it took the major part on the major front in a major war and emerged victorious. And the Royal Navy argues that the blockade won the war, and as Germany, its people starving, turned to revolution. The German Army, of course, in the 1920s, was very happy with this explanation, as it gave them the opportunity to get off the hook of having been defeated, and instead to say that they had been stabbed on the back. The truth is that both are right, but neither is justified in claiming that it exclusively delivered victory. The war was simply too complex and embraced too many moving parts and too many nations and states for monocausal explanations for its outcome to hold good. Thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, a couple minutes then for some questions. If you hold your hand up, we'll bring you the mic. You're next.
Udo. I wonder, sir, if you could answer this question, which isn't directly related to anything which you have raised, but was put in my mind since I was alive for the whole of the Second World War, which seemed to have been started by the same nation as started the First World War.
Yep. Or possibly not. Yes, go on.
Well, we could talk about that one later. What if anything, did Germany hope to gain by entering into such a war in 1914? And was its judgment sound in adopting that particular approach?
The Germany in both wars, 1914 and 1939, is extraordinarily uncoordinated. I mean, people talk about Hitler's Germany as being polycratic chaos, competing departments, making it extraordinarily hard for one person to coordinate. Obviously, Hitler did aspire to coordinate, and Kaiser Wilhelm also aspired to coordinate. But in the case of Germany in 1914, it is extraordinarily confused, because you have the Kaiser at the center of the crisis right at the beginning, where in an impulsive mood he says, "We will support Austria-Hungary." And then he immediately is sent off to sea for the rest of July to go on a Baltic cruise, precisely because his advisors know that he's likely to change his mind, as indeed he did when he returned from his Baltic cruise at the end of July. So there's very little consistency in his mind. The consistency in German policy during July 1914 is the consistency of the German Chancellor, Theobald von Beppenhollweg, who is there in Berlin, the only figure, major figure in Berlin throughout the crisis. And we have a reasonable idea of what he wants to do, because we have the private diary of his secretary, Kurt Riesler. And what he says Beppenhollweg wanted to do was to break the alliance that confronted Germany. He wanted, in other words, a diplomatic crisis. He might possibly have wanted Austria-Hungary to crush Serbia, but it seems pretty clear the last thing he wanted was a world war. And indeed, when he confronted the possibility of a major European war at the end of July, he joined the Kaiser in seeing if he could bring the whole thing to a halt. But by that stage, there were too many other moving parts running. And I think you need to remember that the crisis, when it comes, is a very short crisis. It begins on the 23rd of July, when the Serbians receive the ultimatum from Austria-Hungary, and to all intents and purposes, all of Europe, bar Britain, is at war within a week. And this is an era when there are no real-time communications. Nobody is able to regain control of that crisis. Once they're at war, of course, Germany, as indeed the other powers, forms war aims and objectives which they hope to achieve. But for my money, there is no link between those post-war outbreak war aims and German intentions before 1914.
May I ask, please, with regard to the German peace feelers at the end of 1916, do the German historians whom you mention have evidence that the Germans would give up Belgium and also their lands in France, which they held, the iron ore fields and so on?
Of course, a core question, absolutely. And the basis, it seems pretty clear, for the failure of the negotiations when Woodrow Wilson initiated them too. The German Navy has absolutely no intention of giving up Belgium, because it sees it as giving it a foothold that will enable it to get out of the North Sea. Quite how it imagined it would get out of the North Sea through the Channel, I'm not terribly sure, but it felt that having got additional coastline in the North Sea, it wanted to keep that. The army was less hung up on that, and more hung up, of course, on creating a buffer against Russia in the east. And on the other side of the equation, it's very clear that France is not now prepared to compromise on Alsace-Lorraine, which, of course, Germany regards as its own after 1871, and Britain is equally not prepared to compromise on Belgium. So I think you're entirely right to say there are very significant negotiating stumbling blocks in 1916, and Germany is not so desperate that it's prepared to forego precisely those claims, to particularly the Belgian one. And that is precisely the argument for saying the German historians may have got it wrong. Part of the problem here, again, is that there are so many, there is not coordination. The Navy is asking one thing, the Army is asking for another. There is a very active war aims lobby that is outside government completely. And there is no effective means of coordination. I mean, something I said in the lecture, one of the reasons I think they lose the war is they can't do that.
Question. Time for one more question, please.
It's not really going to be a question, it might be a boast. But you mentioned the British shipping magnates, many from Scotland, but you didn't mention much of the amazing work of the Merchant Navy.
Yeah.
By chance, my grandfather was invited by Lloyd George to be Minister of Shipping.
Right.
They created him a ministry in the bed of the Lake of St. James's Park, which they drained for the purpose. And he organized the Merchant Navy, many Scottish ships, to bring the supplies which you mentioned from America, which made a major contribution to the war. Mm. He also developed the convoy system, much to Lord Jellicoe's disapproval, I believe, but by doing so, saved thousands of ships and many tens of thousands of sailors' lives during the time when the Merchant Navy was operating. I didn't know if you knew that. I'm very proud to talk about it.
Well, I think rightly so. I mean, I did know about it, but I think you're entirely right to say that. I mean, the issue of who's responsible for convoy is, of course, a hotly debated issue. But I think what's also worth saying in all that is, of course, what we now call the Merchant Navy is itself a product of the war. I mean, because the idea that the Merchant Navy was a service rather than simply something, a number of ships owned by ship owners, crewed by people who were employed by the companies, which of course clearly they were, was something that George V gave a sanction to during the course of the war, precisely to elevate the service that merchant seamen were making. But the coordination of Allied shipping was central, and absolutely Britain's contribution and the coordination of that. Part of the challenge here was precisely that having nearly 50% of the world's tonnage, and of course you added to that during the war, you lost a great deal to U-boats, but added to that with the requisitioning of intern German ships in neutral ports, particularly in the United States after America's entry, part of the challenge was the sheer diversity of the sort of tonnage you're talking about. Some of it, of course, made up of speedy passenger liners, which could cross the Atlantic, probably without convoy. And others made up of merchant ships that would wallow around at 8 knots, and which therefore demanded that faster ships conform to their speeds. And of course, much merchant tonnage still carried in sailing ships. And all that presented such a diversity as well as such a magnitude that one of the reasons that the Admiralty felt overwhelmed by the problems of escorting it was that they couldn't quite get their heads around it. And indeed, the initial resistance to convoy was in part generated by assessments of traffic leading British harbours on an ordinary day. Much of that was coastal traffic, of course, that wasn't trying to cross the Atlantic or doing anything else. So it all required information to be put together, which nobody at the outbreak of war had. And of course, during the course of war was against a constantly moving picture because of ships being sunk as the war unfolded. But it's a central contribution. And I would add, not just in that context, not just the achievement within Britain, but that by 1917-18, shipping is being coordinated as an Allied resource so that it is being optimized in the most effective way. I mean, it's a classic illustration of state and private enterprise partnership.
So Hugh Strawn, thank you ever so much for a fantastic talk this evening. Ladies and gentlemen, another round of applause, please.